Initiating Commander's Log Broadcast. Link up complete. Upload successful.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of the Commander's Log, podcast for the Elite Dangerous novel, and Hear the Wheel. Tonight I'll be talking about the Design Decision Forum, catching up with some of the recent topics, then I'll go over the progress with the novel, talk about my audiobook quest, talk about publishing, include a bit of an excerpt from the novel, and then see what we find in the Tionisla system. Busted out a Redquat, had enough of this place, but I'm out. I've just hyped into the Tionisla system, home of the Rec Space, and the Teon is a historical society. So I'm going to fly into the closest orbital and see what happens. Right then, so first up, the Design Decision Forum. Like I was saying, it's been a while since I've been in there, so it was good to catch up with everything. First one I saw was this one about smuggling, and oh my god. Absolute fan squee reading that one. I thought I was going to be Explorer before, but now I'm definitely going to go Millennium Falcon styles in this game. Absolutely. Slate everything out. The contacts, reputation, ship upgrades. Everything's there. It's ticking all my boxes. I'm so looking forward to doing that now. The next one was the multi-ship ownership model. And I got to say, I'm not terribly interested myself in that. I'd imagine that I'd just play it with my one ship and go about my business, but I can sort of see that as you progress through the game and you sort of do everything you can do, and it might be interesting to have your freighter ship and have your small ship. And today when I log on, I'm going to be a bounty hunter. Tomorrow I'm just going to make a quick buck doing some freight work, and you know, perhaps even if you've got your small escort ship, today I'm going to run escort for my mate and help him make some money. And tomorrow he's going to return the favour for me. So, you know, there's definitely some good gameplay options there. Obviously, you know, the advantages of it will come out once you start playing it. Probably something that's going to come in sort of later, perhaps, once people get their feet, sort themselves out and get comfortable with the game. I'm not sure if I'd get into it. The home world of my protagonist. I think that's probably where I'm going to store my ships if I buy them. Or if they've got storage areas, we'll have to see what happens, but I think if I'm going to call anywhere my base, I think it's going to be there. Another one that's come up recently for revision was the rating system. You know, on the face of it, it's definitely an improvement from the previous games, but it feels a bit simplistic, and you've got the good, the bad, neutral, the ugly. But, you know, knowing what happens with the procedural generation, something simple creates something so varied. You know, we've got the recipe here for quite a few permutations. You know, each NPC only cares about a few aspects of the reputation. You know, as a person, you're going to have a reputation in everything, whether it's neutral or not, but the NPC is only going to care about a few of them. So there's actually going to be quite a few options here and quite a few, you know, like I said, permutations for what can and cannot happen in the game. So I think it covers all the bases, to be honest, and I think it'll create some great gameplay there. Obviously, reputations go up and go down. It's interesting how some decay with time and some decay only by doing something stupid. So does that mean that, like espionage for example, I perform a mission well, I acquire some data, and everyone's happy with me, and I get a good espionage ranking, and then I don't do any espionage for a couple of weeks. By that, my espionage ranking won't go down. Though you could argue that my ability to espionage decays with time if I don't practice, the same way bounty hunting decays with time. Doesn't decay with failing to kill someone, obviously. I guess bounty hunting is a good example that you can just, if you fail to kill a bounty, you don't have to tell anyone. What I do like, and what isn't particularly new, I suppose, but the elite rankings and how that works. You know, when I played Elite as a kid, it was on the Atari ST, and when you reached that elite status, a splash screen of the elite logo sort of came up, and then that went away after a few seconds. You went to your status page, and your ranking was elite. 5 letters, all of them capital letters, as opposed to normally they're just sentence case. And that was it. It made no difference to the game. And I never made elite in the other 2 games, so I can't confirm what or what does not happen there, but as I understood, nothing really happened. So the fact that once you reach Elite, your whole game experience is going to change. You're going to have different people talking to you. You're going to have new missions. You're going to be able to do different things. And I think that's a necessity for this game, to make you want to get to Elite, or at least get high enough to get to the club, and then keep you playing after that. I think that's pretty critical. And that's been talked before, so I'm not going to go over it again. But, you know, I'm quite excited about what I read there, and hopefully you guys are too. Another aspect being looked at by the Design Decision Forum is criminality. And double-edged sword here. There's a lot of things here which make me think it's going to be quite hard to be a pirate. But hopefully the gains of being a pirate are so high that it balances that out. On the other side, the police were so useless in Frontier and First Encounters. Just absolutely hopeless. They might as well not have been there. So the fact that the police are going to be more useful, they can stop you hyping jumping, they can interdict you. And it sounds like it's going to be a lot more balanced towards the police. And it's good from one angle. I want the police to be useful because they were so not before. It's going to be hard to be a pirate. I think everyone's going to want to be a little bit criminal at some point in their career. And again, we'll see how the balance comes out in the alpha testing. Anyway, but it does look a little bit hard. A few things that pop out at me though is the witnessing. Obviously, if a tree falls down the forest and nobody hears it, does it make a sound? The answer is yes. It doesn't make a noise, because a noise is a reception of sound by a human. So there's no noise, but it makes a sound. Yeah, if a crime is committed and nobody witnesses it, is it a crime? And it depends what a witness is. If I dump toxic, you know, radioactives from a military drive, for example, in the middle of deep space and no one sees it, I get away with it. If I do it in front of a space station, I get a slap on the wrist. So does that mean that if I find someone, blow the crap out of them in deep space with no one else is around, you would suppose that that player is a witness? And, you know, obviously if they're a member of the Pilots Federation, they can put their own bounty on, which is a pretty cool aspect. But if I target an NPC and kill them, do I get in trouble? Can do it so fast they don't have time to witness their death? I don't know. If a pirate kills another pirate, no one's going to shed a tear, more than likely. So that's probably the way to go. Be a pirate by pirating the pirates. And everybody wins. And finally, communication. Now, communication was basically non-existent in all the games. Elite, there was no communication. And in Frontier and First Encounters, I mean, you could basically write off ship communication completely. I think there's two things you could say, surrender or die, or help them under attack. And if you said help them under attack, no one came to help you. And if you said surrender or die, they laughed at you. No matter how big your ship and how small their ship was, they just laughed at you. So you say it's pretty useless. You did, however, have the ability to negotiate to a degree for jobs on the bulletin board. And with the police, if you got a slap on the wrist, fine, you could try and bribe them. If your bribe was not big enough, they'd feel insulted and up your fine. And hopefully you'd be able to give them a big enough bribe to make that go away. And of course you've got the less than honest traders on the bulletin board as well. So there was some, you know, landed, should we say, like dockside communication that worked. I mean, it was simplistic, but it worked quite well. I think there were some few options there. So obviously Elite Dangerous is going to take that to the next level, bringing in ship communication, which I think is a big one. I hope it doesn't sort of detract from the actual playing itself, but the ability to talk to your mates and organise jobs is critical to the way this game's going to work. So it's definitely needed and definitely going to make the game better. And people are going to find the balance that works for them, obviously. But I'm really interested in the expansion of the player to NPC communications, like, you know, taking the place of the bulletin board, being able to haggle more, or even bluff, as mentioned here. I mean, these kind of things make it a whole new experience, and I'm really looking forward to that. Right then, well, we're coming into the end of July, and if you've been to my website lately and you've clicked on the tab at the top that says The Plan, you'll see that my plan was to complete this edit by the end of July, and I've got 4 days. So how am I going? Well, definitely not going to meet that goal, in a word. So right now I'm on page 213 of 267, so I've got 54 pages to go. And last week was a pretty good week. I got 33 or so pages done. This week might be a bit less. I'm not going to get 54 pages done in 4 days, but I am looking at early August. You know, I really want to get done before the middle of August as the sort of backup plan, because the next step after that is to get it to all my alpha readers. At that stage, I'll probably also send it through to Frontier Developments. Obviously, the plot and the storyline's been approved, but there's aspects within that which they'll need to approve and they need it early enough so they can say, well, we're still working on this. Yes, you can do that. No, you can't. Of course, I've still got a lot of comments left in the document, like Frontier need to confirm this. Don't have the name for the solar system yet. There's a few things like that. So, you know, when Frontier receive it, that will have some details that I'm going to have to talk to them about, other details they're going to have to approve for me. Something else is going to happen though. Once that this edit is complete, I'm going to be sending it out to Steam Press, which is a publisher in Wellington. I met with Stephen Finchin, who's the publisher there, the editor, a couple of weeks ago, and as luck would have it, he played Elite as a child as well. So he knows exactly what I'm talking about and has the passion and the journey that is a crowdfunding campaign to fund a crowdfunding campaign. There's a lot of interest to him. So he's going to have a read and we'll see how that goes. As I've been editing lately, I've come to this part where I've just raced through the editing and then other parts which just were so slow. It took me 1 hour to do one page this week. Just painfully slow. And so I've been thinking about why that is. And obviously, there's some parts of a story which are high-paced, high-tension, and then you've got the slower parts with less tension and are a chance for both the characters and the readers to just take a mental breath. It's like, okay, we're okay, before you mount the next wave and get into the other bit of action. So the general sort of idea for a story is it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds and reaches a climax and then it dies away again. But that's rather a simplistic view of it, because really it should have a sine wave. As it increases in tension, there should be an up and a down, and a mini up and down, as you steadily keep increasing. You need to just give the readers a chance to sort of take stock. If you just go flat tack all the way, you get quite breathless, and it is quite hard for readers, I think. I've had experience with some books which just don't give up. And on one way they're exciting, but on the other time you just can't wrap your head around it. There's just too much going on too fast. But in saying that, the parts that I edit fast and the parts that I edit slow don't tie up with the high tension, the low tension, or the fast pace and the slow pace. There's two scenes. I'm not going to tell you what they are because it'll just give away too much. But both of them were very important action scenes. And one of them, I was editing it and my heart was pumping and, you know, I did feel breathless and my heart was in my throat and it was just zoomed through it. While this other one, just, it was an absolute chore to edit it. And, you know, both of these are high-speed scenes, but one of them worked and one of them didn't. And that's sort of, I think, why editing was so hard. I think the first one was such a good ride. You know, I was living it and experience, even though I wrote it, it was still having a physiological impact on my body. And I went along for the ride, and I think perhaps maybe I wasn't doing a good enough job editing it. I was enjoying it too much. I didn't stop to sort of sniff at the roses and wonder if they're the right colour or the right smell. While in the second scene, obviously just didn't have that X factor to it. If it was hard for me, it's not going to be easy for a reader. So I spent a lot of time on that scene and it's better. Obviously I've got some more editing up my sleeve to do. I've got another 8 months or 9 months to go. So I'm not particularly worried, but it's the kind of thing I want some feedback from my alpha readers on. So I've left it, I've moved on, and we'll see how we go. You know, I think it's still a great scene, but whether there's a lot of room for improvement or not, well, we'll find out and see what readers actually think of it. This edit isn't a perfect edit. I'm aiming for good at the moment. I'm not even aiming for great. I'm just aiming for good. I think if I read and it's not okay, then I edit it. And if it's okay, then I'll leave it. So if it's not okay, I'll fix it. If it is okay, I'll just move on. Because that's where this edit's at. This edit isn't okay to good edit. I've got two more edits to come up, which are going to make it great, and then delete. So that's sort of my process at the moment. Now, I just added a scene which wasn't in the draft. And there's probably been about 4 or 5 scenes so far which I've added in for the story. And I'm very aware of the fact that my word count is rising. Right now, 127,583 words. And that's a lot. I don't know what the best way to put that into perspective is, but that's most books, you know, a decent 400-page book's probably 110,000 words. It's getting pretty big. And obviously, in my later edits, I'm going to be trying to prune that back and really sort of, you know, I've previously called it the flash the light in the eyes, edit, you know, really ask my manuscript some serious hard questions. Do I need this scene? Do I need to talk about this? Do I need to talk about it now? So that's going to happen later to peg those words back, but I am awfully conscious of the fact that my word count's going up. So I thought I needed the scene. So I was, it's a tricky one. So I've edited it now, and I've added it in. It's not a big scene. It's not clogging up the story by any means. I'm going to have to ask myself whether I actually need that scene in there or not. I mean, it provides flavour, and it reminds you that the bad guy is coming. So that the reader can't rest or get comfortable because, you know, death and destruction are winging their way straight to you. Now, that does tie into the novel structure that I try and follow. You have your, you know, your first plot point at 25% or 20-25% where the protagonist gets his mission. And then you've got the midpoint at 50% where more information is provided and everything sort of gets turned on its head. And suddenly the protagonist, instead of being a wanderer, becomes a warrior. And he goes in search of his goal. And then you've got the second plot point at 75%. That last little bit of information which solidifies the protagonist and gives him that last mental oomph to get the job done. In between all that, you can't just focus on the protagonist. So what you do is halfway between the first plot point and the midpoint, you want to put a scene in there where you sort of show the bad guys. Either the reader knows or the character knows or both. Doesn't have to be, the character doesn't have to know, but the reader has to know the bad guys are there. Just to keep the tension up. And again, you generally do that again around the 66%, which is between the midpoint and the second plot point. And that's the scene that I've put in. So it fulfills its requirements there, and it adds flavour. That's two attributes to this scene. And it's not really enough, is what my gut's saying. Is it worth keeping in? Can I add some more to that scene to make it carry its weight for this novel? Or in the end, should I just get rid of it? That's a question I'm going to be asking myself. And again, Alpha Reader is going to be helping me with that. And currently, that scene's actually at page 180 out of the 267, so it's about 69%, not 66%. Close, could be better. It's something I like to just sort of keep in the back of my mind. I'm not worrying about it right now because I haven't finished the edit. Once I finish the edit, I'll know exactly where each part is, and then I can look at moving things around to make sure it's in the right place. But right now, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just sort of keeping a mental note about it. And, of course, the bad guy in this scene is Commander Wagar. So, obviously, I'll get in trouble if I use that name for real. So, if there's any You Name It supporters out there that haven't come up with their name yet, this dude needs a name. If he's of interest, you know, let me know. Here is one sentence from him. It made Wagar's heart sore, as if the EM radiation was filling him, lifting him, readying him for his next move. Does it sound like someone you want to know? If it is, get in touch. john@andhearthewheel.co.nz. Now, I haven't talked about it for probably a couple of months now, but something I've always been aiming towards was an audiobook. And I've been calling it my audiobook stretch goal, based on the parlance from Kickstarter, but I don't know, is stretch goal really the right term anymore? I'm not really stretching, I'm writing and I'm editing, I'm, you know, those starting gates are a long way behind me now. So, should we call it a dream list instead? Audiobook dream list? Or the audiobook dream? Anyway, it's something that I'm still aiming for. In episode 8, when I was talking to Alan, we talked about transmedia and trying to tell the same story or different angles of the same story in different medias and different forms to get to as many people as possible and to give them as much enjoyment with it as possible. And, you know, Alan announced that he's doing an audio drama, which I think is an awesome idea. I don't want to copy him, but it wouldn't really be for me anyway. I'm happy with my audiobook idea, so I'd like to make an audiobook of Anne Hear the Wheel. I don't know how many of you guys have played Half-Life before, and I'll just put it on the record that if Elite was the best game in the universe, Half-Life has to be number two. That's probably being a little bit harsh to Half-Life. Half-Life was brilliant. But then, of course, after you played Half-Life, they brought out Blue Shift, and forget the second one, was it Green Force or Green Strike? Basically, in the first game you played the scientist, Mr. Freeman, and then in Blue Shift you played a guard who worked in the same building, and then in the other game you played an armed soldier who comes in to clean up the mess that Gordon Freeman made. And so they're different characters, the same setting, the same events to a degree, or the same catalyst, but they explore different areas, they see different things, they cross over at quite a few interesting points, and that was a really to me, a really interesting way to do it. And I thought that was, you know, you got the same story, but you got three different stories coming out of the same story. That was, I was at university at the time, I thought it was mind-blowingly awesome, to be honest. And if I can do something like that with And Hear the Wheel, that would be absolutely brilliant. But there are license issues there. But it's something I'm going to think about anyway. But at the moment, the plan is an audiobook of, you know, a novelization in audio format as opposed to some other version. So that's what I'm aiming for. And still getting money in from the website. So thank you everyone who's donated. I've had nearly £600, which is around 900 New Zealand dollars. So it's nearly halfway there to the minimum I thought I needed to get a studio to do the recording. In terms of the recording gear, I still haven't really spent any time on that. I still reckon I can probably source that pretty cheaply through my contacts and my mates, but I haven't really been following it up. Priority right now is to get this edit done, and once that's done, I'm waiting for the off readers to get back to me. I've got some time to sort of sit and think about these things. So once again, thanks everyone for putting your money in through PayPal on the website. I've had another You Name It supporter come on board, so that was fantastic, and they've got some ideas there, so I'm working with them on that. That's really great. If you're interested in audiobook, or if you're just interested in pre-ordering the book, or, you know, getting my newsletters, or, you know, being an alpha reader, any of these things, you can still join up to become supporters. It's all available on the website, andhearthewheel.co.nz. Check it out, and if anything is of interest there, you know, sign up. That'd be fantastic. No thanks, mate. I think if I started dealing in tree grubs, which I thought were extinct, anyway, but Alan probably wouldn't be too happy with me if I did that, so I think I'll just leave it. Not that you don't sound legitimate. Yes, definitely above board. Just work on that sales pitch, my mate. Alright, see you later. Now, where was I? Alright, a bit of a treat for you guys. So I've got a bit of an excerpt for you. It's about 300 words. It's quite late in the novel. I don't think it gives anything away. But if you're really, really scared, you might sort of skip the next couple of minutes. It was dawn, wherever here was, and cold. The pot had crashed the right way up, jutting out of a lake of ice at an acute angle. Beyond the distant icy mountains, the sky was an ominous deep purple, like the bruising you got around your kidneys after a bit of foul play. You could see he was strapped in now and found the release button by his fingers. The pod wasn't designed for imprisonment, it was designed for easy egress. The straps unfurled and he stepped awkwardly down into the ice. The wind bit into him, fresh from the mountains and sapping his dwindling heat away. He rubbed his arms, hugged himself tight to reserve what he could. At least she hadn't stripped him of his pressure suit before she'd dumped him, though he didn't understand why she hadn't just killed him. Perhaps Lady Luck had finally decided to stop shitting on him, because he was free. Free to find his boys and get back to his life, which is what he'd been wanting all this time. So why couldn't he stop thinking about her? There's some kind of complex hugging the craggy rock face of the distant hills. There's at least one satellite dish and aerials big and wide enough to be only high-def uplinks. A listening station for sure. He'd hit a few of those in his day. Not much booty in the classical sense, though the communication gear was always welcome in the distant colonies. What was really valuable was the data that you could mine. Someone, somewhere, always wanted the data. Pirating would be a whole lot harder with only one dominant government in the galaxy. He sent Gunn a silent good luck. The noise rolled across the ice and his gaze dropped to a pair of snowy plumes, two dirty splodges racing across the stark plains, a parachute of ice crystals flying behind them. Racing forward, racing towards him. They knew he was here. Right, well, hope you enjoyed that. Another one of those bulletin boards. It's not reading right. What's it saying? Now I'll just open up the link. Hysterical Society. Good one. Hang on. So that's a ship connected to the bulletin board.
Excuse me. You're not actually supposed to dock with those.
This is my bulletin board. Hang on a second. That's better. Can you read off what the sign says for me? Awesome. Damn cheap matrix. Let me tell you, never buy discount from a Deason.
Let me guess. David Hughes.
The one and only. You sound familiar.
Well, Dave, you might remember me from such fan fiction epic sagas as the huge plasma accelerator, which is available on, well, your site.
Oh, John Harper. Of course, I should have recognised the accent. Nice of you to stop by. You're one of those people I've known for nearly a decade but never spoken to. Have you seen much of Jack Hamilton lately?
Jack Hamilton? Well, it's a blast from the past. No, he hasn't been up to much lately at all. Vasquez de Havilland, as you know from the HPA saga, and the novel I was writing before I jumped onto the Elite novel. His name is James DeSoto, so no, Jack Hamilton's been taking it easy at the moment.
Well, you remind of many characters.
Absolutely. So, Mr. Hughes, recorder of history and world builder by day, bulletin board technician by night?
Well, when you pay bargain basement prices, you need that personal touch to make it work. Sometimes with a hammer.
For sure. Have you been talking to Fozzer?
Oh, incessantly. Much to his chagrin.
So how's everything with you? Bulletin boards aside.
Things are okay, thanks. Been a hairy couple of weeks and the pressure's on with the first public rules test release coming up, so it's been a bit manic.
Oh, yeah, who are you testing it on? Local people or some of your backers? Or?
Some of the backers. I mean, I've got two groups that are set up ready to go. There's an alpha testing group and a game development forum group, which will eventually put into place, hopefully by the end of this month.
So it's sort of their job to come up with the most complicated gameplay that they can to make sure they don't break your rules? Is that the sort of the point?
Well, in theory, I'm supposed to be providing them with a test game, like a sample game to go through. But I'm quite right. Happy for them to go with whatever they want to do to test it. They can test it their way. Because obviously anything that they come out with that's outside my box, so to say, is going to be better for test.
And so on top of all that, you managed to get down to LaveCon. How was that?
Oh, LaveCon was awesome. It was one of the best experiences ever. Lave Radio guys are the best, and they did a great job setting up that convention. It's the first convention, but you couldn't tell. It was really quite professional. It was great to be part of it, and even more fantastic to be involved as I was.
Yes, well, I heard about you on the writers' panel. Very, very jealous. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks. To be honest, it was the writers' panel was one big panic attack, but it was still awesome, from what I can remember of it, through the alcohol-fueled haze. Sitting next to the Michael Brooks didn't help the panic much, though.
You got through it, though. That's the main thing. And I know that you've been talking a lot with Michael Brooks, so he didn't have any elbow nudges for you or any complaints face-to-face with you?
Well, he did say a couple of things to me. apparently...
Leave me alone.
Stop emailing me was pretty much the hint I was getting. I've been, as you say, I've been talking to him quite a lot, and he's sort of hinted that I'm perhaps the biggest workload he has at the moment in regards to the writers, which I'm not entirely sure is a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know how he feels about it, but you know, I'm hoping that through that interaction it's going to develop a good product.
Yeah, it'll be. It's maybe perhaps even if it is a bad thing for Michael Brooks, it's a good thing for the project for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm not a very big RPG role-playing game person. In fact, you could say I'm not really one at all. So can you talk me through your project in layman's terms?
Yeah, sure. The project's full title is Elite Encounters Role-Playing in the Elite Universe. It's a tabletop role-playing game that lets groups of people meet up and create stories together. One person takes on the role of games master or storyteller and creates the story. The other players are actors who take on the parts of the characters in that story. Players are usually allowed to do pretty much whatever they want, but it's the games master's job to try and keep them to the plot of the story without sort of herding them, as it were. Role-playing games like this have been around since the 70s. You probably heard of the original Dungeons & Dragons.
Yep.
That was the first role-playing game to become really popular, and since then it's kind of spread to different settings. D&D was fantasy, and from then it spread into things like science fiction, horror, and pretty much any genre, really. The things that we call role-playing games today, people of a slightly younger generation than you or I, perhaps, usually refer to those as computer games, or things like Neverwinter Nights, that kind of thing. But they were mostly based on these pen and paper role-playing games. And I think RPGs now are starting to make a bit of a comeback, to be honest with you. I think it's gone full circle, because I think we discussed this in one of the late radio shows, actually, was that the computer role-playing games now are actually inspiring people to come back to pen and paper role-playing.
That's pretty fantastic, yeah. Well, I have actually played Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. That's, I guess, a similar thing, isn't it, really? You've got an attack level and a defence level, and you've got a weapon of +3 or whatever, and the computer does rolls the dice instead of you rolling the dice, that kind of thing, I suppose.
That's it, yeah. That's exactly right, yeah.
Sorry, just for my own interest, the game master makes the story, but obviously, I mean, you're providing the rules, is it? Or just sort of boundary conditions so they can do whatever the hell they want within limitations? Or do you actually set sort of plot options? Or, you know, how does that work?
Well, I can only speak from my point of view. The way that I generally used to run a game, I don't do it very often now, hence the used it, was I would set out a general plot arc, like where they start, some general waypoints they've got to reach on the way, and then a final goal that they've got to achieve. And then it's like the players do what they want to achieve that. I actually found through sort of 15 years of pretty much constant playing, if you write down a very set story, then you'll never get to half of it. So I used to write down this general plot arc, and then every time the player said, I want to do this, it would be made up on the spur of the moment. So it's a very creative thing to do, I find, and it keeps you, as a creative person, it keeps you on your toes, and yeah, it's an interesting experience. I've always found that I've sat and wrote pages and pages of plot and pages of character interactions and stuff like that. And the more work you usually spend on doing that, the more likely it is the characters are going to go in a completely different direction.
Right. And so to pay for your fiction license, obviously you did a Kickstarter campaign like the rest of us writers, I suppose. Would you call it a scary experience? You know, personally for me, I was on the wrong side of the planet. So during the day, not much happened. And then all the action was happening at night mostly, or, you know, late at night, you know, while I was sleeping. So, you know, I'd wake up and the first thing I'd do is check the email to see what had happened. So there was a lot of downtime for me and then a lot of sheer terror. So what was your experience like?
I think the sheer terror thing, yeah, is a bit right. Boredom's definitely what I wouldn't associate with the Kickstarter process, put it that way. The lead up to it was exciting and kind of scary. Michael Brooks did a wonderful job steering me in the right direction for that campaign content. We stretched the Rose of the Writer's Pledge a lot when we set this up, and I'm really grateful to him for his patience and his support. First week was panic and gratitude as the pledges came in, and level of support there was amazing. The middle 2 weeks were frustrating and a little bit scary because everything really slowed down, which apparently is normal for a Kickstarter. And then that last week was just madness. The last 24 hours was just one big, long adrenaline rush. It was really humbling. In fact, that last few weeks, as people just kept on pledging and pledging and pledging. That last few days, sorry. And especially that last few hours. Just people kept on pledging and raising their pledges and saying, right, let's try and reach these stretch goals now. And the support there was awesome. And it's just, it's amazing to think that there are so many people out there who have got so much faith in someone who hasn't written a book before. And, you know, that was pointed out, and it's a fair point. I'm unpublished. I've never done this before. But to raise over £7,000 just on faith alone is an amazing experience, and it's, you know, these people have put me in a position to achieve a dream, hopefully.
You know, it's really, really exciting. You know, with all the work you've done, all that fan work you've done previously, you know, around the history of the Elite Universe and filling in those gaps and everything you've done, looking at the designs of the ships and, you know, where everything's going to fit, I mean, it's not like you're a nobody. Obviously, people have been to your site and you know, like me, I know you, and, you know, you do have some history there. But, you know, I liked your little talk about the last 24 hours. I think for me, I was 2 days out, and I was dead and buried, you know. I was thinking, oh, it's going to take a miracle to get there. And then I got a really massive pledge, you know, over $1,000. I was like, oh, my God, I'm suddenly, this could actually happen. And my wife doesn't get science fiction. It's of no interest to her. And she thought I was mad for doing this Kickstarter, Indiegogo campaign for me. But that last sort of hour, we were both in front of the laptop, you know, at the kitchen bench, and she was the one pressing the F5 key, saying who else, you know, what pledges are coming. And like you say, just the money that people were throwing at you, it was flattering and it was overwhelming, and it was, these people don't know you, but they were pledging this money to you, and it was really humbling. It was a crazy experience.
It was, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, on that last day, I know what you mean about the big pledge at the last minute, because there was even though I was across the line by that point, there was a really brilliant guy pledged £500 for the system naming pledge that I put on there. And I just couldn't believe that someone had done that. And that is such an expression of faith, an expression of support for something that you're doing. That I can't thank these people enough. I mean, the thing is, in a sense, I mean, it doesn't really matter how much people pledge, whether it's £500 or £5. It's still, people are putting their hard-earned cash towards it. And it's just something you can't I don't think you can beat it.
Well, it puts the pressure on, doesn't it? I mean, if you're just doing a self-published whatever, it doesn't really matter. But people have paid you, and you've got to front up with the goods. Otherwise, even just from a personal angle, if you're not holding up your end, you're going to give yourself crap, let alone the people that have paid your money.
I felt a bit guilty during the process, or the process since the Kickstarter, because I've not been doing as many updates as I would like to do. I've only been really managing to do one a month. But if I think about it, I'm quite engaged with the community as well, and you know, it all adds up to the fact that I'm in there, I'm taking hints and taking advice from people and listening to what people have got to say as well.
I mean, I update weekly, but I wonder if I'm updating too much.
Drew said the same thing this week, didn't he? You and Drew are both thinking you're doing too much, but I don't know. I don't know if you can do too much. I mean, you do podcasts, don't you?
I know, like I do every week. I sort of tell you, I write down where I am with my editing and a few examples of what I've been doing, and then I give, you know, sometimes I do a bit of a blurb with it. You know, Drew comes up with a topic to discuss while I sort of more look at what I've been doing with the novel, and if something relevant to what I'm doing and the novel comes up, then I sort of discuss it. So a different angle, but it's normally a good night's effort to put up an update, you know, and I could be writing when I'm doing that.
To be honest, I would rather quite spend the time doing the book rather than doing the updates, but I have a tendency to ramble when I'm writing, that's the problem. So if I'm doing an update, you've probably noticed that the updates I do are about 50-page treatises on pretty much everything I'm doing. And hopefully that makes up for the fact I've not done one for 4 weeks before that. But I think you and Drew do slightly shorter ones. So I think it balances out in the end. I think as long as you're engaging the community and as long as you're keeping them up to date with what you're doing, I don't think it really matters how often you do it.
So going back to the Kickstarter then, I've been getting some more money in, and I've just had another pledger come in to join me on the You Name It level, one of my higher ones, which was quite exciting, and she's already chosen who she wants to name. I mean, so the pledger awards, the design of them has been a bit of interest to me. And we ordered something different. I've done newsletters and proofreading, and Drew's done lines of dialogue, and Alan has a soundtrack and manuscript editing and you know, parts in the movie that he's making. And obviously the anthology has stories and artwork to make the anthologies. And you went down the road of fluffy dice.
Hey, they're not fluffy. They're 16mm cubes of pure joy, they are.
I know, giving you crap. But the photo I saw of them, they looked like a pretty good quality thing with a little... What is the elite bird? I always call it a phoenix in my head, but what actually is it? Is it just a firebird? Or I played on the Atari ST, and the guy who translated the Atari ST, I think the company was Firebird, so I've always thought of it as a firebird, but...
Well, the official line from Frontier is it's a griffin.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Or the bird's meant to be a griffin. But, I mean, it's had loads of names. It's had the Elite logo, it's been the Firebird, because of the fact that Firebird was the publisher as well back in the day.
Right.
It's been called the Robotic Avian, because I think Andy Redman's imprint book actually called it the Robotic Avian, because it's apparently mounted on the front of the Galcott building.
Yeah, okay.
But I think one of the newsletters from Frontier said that it's just basically called the Elite Federation's logo.
Yeah, well, with that on your dice, that they look like 16mm cubes of pure joy, as you said. Yeah, perfect fit for an RPG book. What else did you think about doing as pledge rewards?
Oh, I had loads of ideas. I do card modelling as a hobby, for one, so it was a natural fit to offer specially designed models of elite ships as part of it. I wanted to do custom design models of pretty much any ship, then suddenly realised that, you know, I've only got a year to do this. If I'm spending all that time designing card models, then I'm not going to get a book written, am I? I also wanted to do 3D miniatures, like 3D printed miniatures, and maybe trading cards and stuff like that. And then my imagination was going daft with it. I had loads of different ideas. And of course, every time I had one, I'd email Michael and say, Michael, is it okay if I do this? And he had to sort of say to me more than once, this is a writer's pack, not a multimedia development pack. You're really stretching the borders of what you're doing. Stop it. Yeah, you can arrange me in a bit. The dice were pretty... I was pretty lucky to be able to do the dice, to be honest with you. And it was restricted to the fact that I could only offer them during the Kickstarter, or as part of Kickstarter reward. And designed a special little logo to go on the dice for that, which is kind of an amalgamation of the original Elite logo, which is the bottom half of the logo, and the new Elite logo, which is the wings, and it kind of melds into each through the middle where the Elite badge is. Yeah, I was quite happy with that design. It came out really clean. I was amazed how much detail they managed to get into that. I mean, the company is brilliant that did that, and they kept me up to date with all the different things they were doing with it. Because originally they were supposed to be just plain black dice with silver imprints on them, and then they eventually upgraded it to gold dice because I ordered over 500 of them.
How many a pack, or, you know, when you pledged, how many did you get?
You could just buy dice. Yeah, there was four different pledge levels you could get dice with. If you put £2 extra onto each of the actual book pledges, the single version electronic one, or the triple version electronic one, or the loose leaf one, or the print on demand one, get two dice, or you could then just, whatever you did, you could just spend a pound and buy a dice. I think the minimum I got was one dice, and the maximum dice was 24, I believe.
Right then, so, you know, it's halfway between when the Kickstarter finished for Elite and when the game's going to come out. So how are you tracking? Are you happy with your progress? You had any hold-ups? Racing ahead of schedule?
Overall, I'm pretty happy, yeah. The game system I'm happy with. I've spent about a month tweaking that since last month. But the progress on the sample adventure has been a lot slower than I'd hoped it would be. I've developed more in other areas than I thought I would have by now, so that balances it up a bit. But yeah, it's going well. Ahead of schedule, I don't think so. Behind schedule a little bit is probably more realistic. You know, I'll get a few weeks of good hard work in there and I should be able to catch up again.
We touched on this before, how you were, you know, talking to Michael Brooks and asking for a lot of things and getting shut down a bit perhaps, but I remember you asking about detailed colour drawings or maybe some ship schematics or something. Can you give us a teaser of any of the awesomeness that'll be in your book?
Tempting. I think you'll just have to wait till it's published, to be honest. I'm hoping to have some cool concept art in there and some technical details and so on that I know RPG fans will love and Elite fans will probably love as well. But I'm going to have to wait and see on them. Technical schematics and so on are a great idea, but the problem with that is I think Frontier's done that already. So that's kind of taking that away a little bit, because if they've got one and I do one on my own, then they're going to be in conflict. So that was a lovely idea. But I think more of the awesome stuff that's going to be in there is the background stuff, I think. There's quite a lot of that that's coming out from Frontier's writers group, which I'm obviously lucky enough to be a part of. And I just need to work out what they're going to allow me to put in there. So
this is a question that is constantly in my mind. Is the project taking over your life, or are you managing that mythical work-life balance that so many people talk about?
Work-life balance. I've heard about that. I don't think I believe in it, though. Some weeks life takes over, and some weeks I spend more time on this game than I should do, so I think it all balances out in the end. I'm about averaging out the 3 evenings a week rule that I promised myself that would be a good balance between having enough time to write a book and retain a healthy marriage. There are some weeks, though, it doesn't happen. There have been a couple of weeks where I've not managed to get anything in at all, and there's been some weeks where I've sat 5 or 6 days writing on, and then by the time it gets to the Saturday, my wife's looking at me with the tapping foot going, how are you managing the workload? Have you had any comments from your family that they just remember when you were around, but you're not anymore?
Yeah, I get a few comments from my wife, for sure. Don't think she's always appreciative of how much time I put into it. You know, I try and do something every day, and basically say to myself that I use all my spare time. But that spare time is less work, less sleeping, less spending time with the kids, getting the kids to sleep, having dinner, spending time with my wife. Then once she's asleep, that sort of gives me, you know, maybe an hour at night to do something, whether that's working out, going for a run, working on the book. Lunch breaks at work, of course, that's just completely dedicated to the story. So, yeah, I always try and get something done every day. I don't know. I'm looking forward to finishing this edit and having a bit of a break, to be honest. So how's the real world treating you then? England is having a summer. Wellington just gets storms that knock shit over and earthquakes that knock more stuff over. Not really half as fun as what's happening up in England.
Oh, I hate heat. It's humid here, it's hot and it's uncomfortable. But I must admit, I think earthquakes put it into perspective. I think, you know, we're lucky here at the moment. So I've got 3 fans on here and it's still not enough to keep us cool. Other than that, there's a few challenges in my life at the minute, but hopefully nothing I can't cope with. The temptation to pack up the tablet and write the game in a pub beer garden is really strong, but I know the quality would suffer a bit after the first couple of pints, so I'll try and resist that.
All right then, so tell me, February 2014, what do you think you'll be doing?
Panicking, most likely. I'm hoping by that time I'll be finalising the print-on-demand stuff and putting final touches to the rewards. If my schedule holds, the book content should be approved and signed off by then. But then, you never know. At most, there might be some last-minute rewrites as Frontier release more game stuff or media to me or the public that I can add into it. Because I know one thing they're not prioritising at the moment is ship designs and ship information and so on. So because my book's supposed to contain a lot of ship information, I may be rewriting that right up to the end. But I'll have to wait and see on that. The big question is the background material, though. I mean, how much Frontier is going to allow me to put in the book and how much more stuff's going to come out before the end as well. So that's the big worry at the minute, anyway.
It's always a work in progress, isn't it, really? When you're working in someone else's universe and that universe isn't finished yet, you're always having to, you know, I'd like to be finished the writing this year and dealing with publishing-related things next year, but, you know, there might be lots of touching up to do as Frontier finalise their own information.
That sounds about right. It's just what Frontier let us have and what Frontier will allow us to do, and just hope that we don't go too far above the amount they're going to let us put in and that they don't need too many rewrites come the end of it all.
Right, well, I guess I should keep moving. These live slaves are fertilizer, won't sell themselves. So, yeah, might head off and see you around.
No worries, mate. I've got a meeting with Professor Lake in about, 20 minutes ago. Oh, thanks for stopping by, anyway.
All right, mate. We'll catch up later.
No doubt.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast. We're going to finish with a bit of a treat this time around. It's a new unpublished piece of music from PA Groove. He's a long-time commander who came into contact with Elite when his dad brought it on the Acorn Electron. He later played it on the PC, Elite Frontier. Then what happened next was what he calls the Dark Ages, when he didn't play much of Elite, but played things like TIE Fighter, X-Wing, Freelancer. Those were all pretty good, but didn't have that spirit of Elite which he was craving. And in 2006 he found Ulite, which he's played pretty much every day since. For him, Ulite is the ultimate Elite due to the fact you can expand it with expansion packs and pretty much make whatever storyline you want. He's actually done a few expansion packs as well, one of his most successful being the Famous Planets OXP. He's also made music for the game as well. Yeah, he's got a bit of experience with music. At one point he actually had a record contract, but now he just makes music for the hobby. And the whole reinvigoration of Elite has inspired him to make some more spacey music, which he makes with a combination of electronic synths and music apps. It was actually via the Ulite bulletin board that he heard about the Elite Dangerous Kickstarter, and he backed it, and he's looking forward to the new game, although he might not have the computer good enough to play it. So that's a little bit about PA Groove, and this is his new piece called Witch Space.
Uplink deactivated. Signal loss confirmed. Commander's log broadcast terminated.